The following programming is sponsored by Mark J. Bernstein. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group. Entrepreneur, author, and financial consultant Mark Bernstein helps high-performing entrepreneurial business owners create a vision for the future and follow through on their goals and intentions. Ange Honorato is a business growth strategist who blends psychology and business together to create conscious leaders and business owners who impact the world. Founders Forum is a radio show podcast sharing the real stories behind entrepreneurship as founders discover more about themselves while providing valuable lessons and some fun and entertainment for you. Now, here's Mark and Ange.
Good morning, America. How are you today? Good morning, Arlo. Arlo's going on a field trip with me this afternoon to Chester Springs.
I bet. Did you pack his lunch?
No, we don't. He doesn't eat lunch. He eats breakfast and he eats dinner. It's my Bernedoodle. My puppy. He's almost not a puppy anymore. Anyway, so this morning we have a very exciting and interesting show, and it's about food. And we're actually pre-recording another show today that's also about food. So on food, we've never really talked about food on this, and it's very current on my mind because I'm in the middle of a juice fast this week, which does wonders if you haven't tried it. It's, you know, gets rid of inflammation. It's like, it provides you with all this energy that you might be missing, etc. But anyway, not advertising that. But I thought we'd start out with a couple of quotes about food. I always like to think you are what you eat. You've heard that. Not everyone necessarily believes that. You know, some people think we're destined to eat certain kinds of foods. That's what cows are for, and that's what, you know, animals are for, etc., whatever. And, you know, there's two schools of thought. But I have a couple quotes that I just want to see what you got, what you all think about this. First of all, think before you eat, people. Food should be the life of you, not the death of you. Interesting. And another one is, tell me what you eat, and I will tell you what you are. And the last one is, you know, there are people, you've heard this, there's a book out, I think it's Dr. Hyman, that says, eat to live instead of live to eat. I have friends, and I'm sure we all do, who definitely live to eat. And I was sort of brought up in a culture that was sort of live to eat, you know, as many of us were. And I know you can relate to that, Ange, probably Amy as well. But I prefer to think about, you know, eating to live. Anyway, what do you think, Ange? What are your thoughts on
that? Well, this is definitely an interesting topic for me because, as you know, I'm dealing with some inflammation problems of my own in a major way right now, needing a new hip and fun things like that. And I just think that there's a lot to be said for that first quote in particular. I think our food supply is obviously very different than it was growing up because I could eat the same foods now that I grew up eating and I have a very different reaction to them. So I am excited for our guest today because I can't wait to hear about healthy food and where it comes from and why we have it, you know, in new forms. So
that has nothing to do with age, the fact that you have, I'm just curious.
nor the fact that I play ice hockey or do other things,
right,
but no,
right.
it's an inherited inflammation problem for sure. Gut issues to boot.
I meant
the
fact that you react to foods differently now than you did then.
Oh, well that could be very well too, but yeah, I never used to have inflammatory problems. So who knows?
Anyway, our resident food expert today is Amy, who I'll introduce in a moment. What are your thoughts on this, on this subject?
I have two thoughts. One is as a practice of eating, but the other is as an entrepreneur in the food space. You know, it's easy to, and we can make assumptions about why people choose to eat what they eat. And that is at the root of like what I'm trying to figure out every day, which is how can I convince somebody to try my product?
Right. And your product, we'll get to that in a second, but it happens to be, I believe, one of the healthiest things out there that you can eat. But we'll see. We'll let you talk about that. So our guest today is Amy Zeitelman, and she started Soom Foods, Soom, S-O-O-M, with which I'm very familiar. And the product she brought in that's on the desk, it's like, I'm not eating today, but I would love to eat some because I've had it, and it's a great product. And as you'll see, she started the business with her two older sisters, which I think is interesting, and we might touch on that a little bit, in 2013. With a mission to make tahini a more popular ingredient in the U.S. market. Many of you may be familiar with it. Many of you may not know much about tahini. I happen, it's one of my actually favorite go-to foods. Soom has been featured in Bon Appetit, Food and Wine, the New York Times, and other media as they're the preferred tahini of many top chefs like Michael Solomonoff of Zahav Restaurant, which is not only one of the top restaurants in Philadelphia, but one of the top restaurants in the country. And Amy is the author of the Tahini Table cookbook and lives in Penn Valley, almost around the corner from our radio station, with her husband and three sons. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So let's talk about that for a second. I want to hear your story, but talk about, expand on what you were saying in regard to how you think about food and how you think about making this an ingredient in people's lives and why.
Yeah, I mean, when people are conscious about what they're choosing, which people are every day, whether it's because of financial reasons or health reasons or dietary goal reasons, people, there are so many inputs. I think you guys will appreciate it from the psychological perspective of what makes people choose to do anything, but also what they're choosing to purchase, to buy, to cook with that day. And selling an ingredient like tahini where, A, a lot of people don't know what it is or are not that familiar with it, or B, may not know the full depths of its applications, every day is an opportunity to either introduce tahini or teach something new about tahini to potential and current consumers. So I think about it all the time.
Since we're on the subject, do you want to say anything about the nutritional benefits of tahini?
Yeah, absolutely. So for those of you that are unfamiliar, tahini is an ingredient made from 100% roasted and ground sesame seeds. It's thicker than olive oil and thinner than peanut butter, but can be used for both in savory and sweet recipes. So that's our baseline. Sesame seeds, though, are a great source of protein, calcium, iron. It's rich in omega fatty acids.
Healthy
it's rich
fats.
In phosphorus and magnesium. I mean, it's very nutritionally dense. So,
And you get your tahini seeds, if I recall, from Ethiopia.
Primarily from Ethiopia, but also being sourced from other parts of mostly Northeast Africa. Yes, but sesame, like other commodities, you know, grow different in different regions. The sesame seed in Ethiopia, a white humare variety in particular, has been really celebrated for the past decade, 15, 20 years, as the best type of seed for tahini. And that's when my sisters and I kind of got inserted into this world of tahini and sesame seeds over 13 years ago now, 2011.
And your dark chocolate tahini is still healthy. Dark chocolate's a good thing for health. And we, as we said, sesame seeds are a great thing. So,
yeah, exactly.
And it's just delicious.
It's just three ingredients: tahini, powdered pure cane sugar, and cocoa powder. Our dark one also has some sea salt in it. So if you like Nutella or have a sweet tooth, the chocolate spread is, it is really delicious.
Very nice. So tell us how you got in this crazy. I do need to say that Amy is a fellow graduate of the University of Delaware as a fighting blue hen. We got to talk about that a little bit. So this started somewhere around or right after college, I believe.
Exactly. I was a senior at University of Delaware, and I think you'll appreciate this. My oldest sister called me one day and was like, "What do you know about tahini?" And I'm like, "You know, we know it from Israel. It's in hummus. You put it a sauce on falafel." And she said, "Jackie is dating Omri." Our middle sister, Jackie, was dating her now husband, Omri. And Omri was in the tahina, or as we call it here in the States, tahini industry in Israel. He was buying tahini from manufacturers and selling it to his own network of restaurants and hummus makers and caterers and hotels. And Jackie liked to help him. Entrepreneurship kind of runs in our blood. Both of our parents are entrepreneurs. 3 out of 4 of our grandparents are entrepreneurs. Like, it's definitely there. And, my oldest sister, Shelby, she went to University of Pennsylvania. She studied entrepreneurial management and understood the foundation of what it meant to start a business. And because of the inspiration from Omri and then evaluating the market here in the States and realizing a few things. One, most people had no idea what tahini was. You could only find it on the bottom shelf of the international aisle with dust on the lids. And if they did know what it was, they only used it for hummus and they couldn't name the brand name. So entrepreneurial speaking, that sounded like a great opportunity. In reality, it's very, very challenging to tackle.
We'll talk about that. If you do find it on the shelves in supermarkets today, which I know you do, where would you find it now as opposed to the bottom shelf in the international aisle?
Great question. Now it's on the bottom shelf of the nut butter section.
but moving up in the world, though,
because
right?
People are getting more into the nut butters and alternatives. Yeah,
exactly. We worked really hard to get it into the nut butter category because of its application like a nut butter. But what's been interesting for us, we just launched into our first conventional chain, Publix, down in Florida, you know, the Southeast.
Oh, we know it well, right, Mark?
We do.
We love Publix. Mm-hmm. And they put us in the kosher section.
That was
section.
The only game in town where I was in Florida. So
pretty much everywhere in Florida, I think.
And people love it. And they're providing great food. And they're expanding to younger brands now. We're actually very pleased with Publix. And nice. When they took our tahini in, they slotted it where tahini was already sold, which is the kosher section, which is part of a larger international aisle. So for the first time in 10 years, for the past 6 months, we've been strategizing about the kosher set as opposed to the nut butter set. So it's been interesting.
Excellent. So how are you doing in terms of sales? And, you know, I know it's growing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
We're growing a lot. I mean, in the first 5 years of the business now. So what happened was we did our market research. I then lived in Israel for a year, loved to experience the culture. We went to Ethiopia for the first time. And then in January of 2013, I moved to the Philly area, actually in with my aunt and uncle, and started working on our first import. And we received that first import at the end of April or early May of 2013. And so since our sales have really been for about 10 years now, and it was fun. For the first 5 years, we doubled, 100% year over year. We had an omni-channel sales approach originally where we were selling on our website a little bit, selling into local grocery stores, independent markets and co-ops, and then selling to restaurants. And what we learned very quickly with the likes of Mike Solomonov and other restaurants that we sold to across the country was that the restaurant industry provided a ton of value for us as it related to the business strategy, the foundation of several aspects of making tahini more popular. So we really leaned into restaurants. Since then, the company continues to grow. We sold over 1.25 million pounds of tahini last year in 2023.
Sounds like a lot.
Yeah. And we finished the year also in 3,500 grocery stores. So all of our channels are really starting to grow now.
So you're still doing the omni-channel approach. You're still at that.
We are, yeah. I mean, we really retracted and leaned into restaurants for quite a while. COVID kind of, and also having the product available on Amazon helped us kind of accelerate back into more channels, especially retail.
So you mentioned challenges before, and you've hinted at it in these comments. Anything else you want to add in the way of challenges that you've faced over the last 10 years?
Oh, man. I mean, it's numerous. So for those of you familiar with tahini, you might know that it's a very messy ingredient. We've had our fair share of big spills, which is pretty frustrating. We've had our fair share.
It's like an oil spill.
It is like an oil spill. Actually, what our warehouse team, what we figured out, it's like a puke spill. Like you have to throw down, like dust on it and then kind of mop it up.
Wow.
And now we have
flashbacks
whole
of elementary school and the school bus accidents. Yeah.
I have to say that's one I didn't think of.
And I should never have said that in, the context of tahini. But yes, it's a very messy product. We've had our fair share of spills.
Messy products can be fun to eat, though. Too.
They can be. It's also a heavy product. So shipping it has been challenging. We've learned a lot as it relates to the supply chain, both small parcel and, truckloads or less than truckloads. The challenges have been numerous.
How about your employee culture? And I know Angie's going to want to ask you about that. Why don't you finish?
Yeah, so before we go to break here, I think that question kind of dovetails in your case in two ways. So one, I think it's interesting to learn about the culture working with your two sisters, family businesses in general, but two sisters. I have two sisters in a somewhat of a business environment, so I'm really curious to learn how that is both a challenge and opportunity, but then also how does that influence the culture that you're creating, right? Because obviously, as you prepare for even more exponential massive growth and hiring a lot more people, I'm sure culture is a big piece of what you want to, incorporate into that.
Yeah. Culture is a big piece. And when it was just me and my sisters, we were really intentional about setting boundaries and kind of, as much as we could, being young and inexperienced, shaping some type of culture. But we knew that we wanted to respect each other's work-life balance. We knew that we needed work-life balance, like as a family unit. Sometimes when we're getting together for dinner, we shouldn't be talking about the business or, sorry, right, mom and dad, we just don't want to answer your questions tonight. And it was also always respecting where each other was at in our life stages as it relates to the roles and responsibilities that we had within the business. So there at no point was intense animosity at any time between any of the sisters, which was really important. But you'll probably relate to this also. Our middle sister lives in Israel, so that creates an interesting boundary as it relates to decision-making, especially what is decided on at manufacturing. All of our manufacturing is done in Israel. Jackie and Omri also are very involved in the supply chain to Ethiopia, so she really touches and helps us on the supply chain side. But operationally, Shelby, my oldest sister, and I were here on the ground. So that contributed a lot to the decision making. But as it related to our own work-life balance, we've always, from day one, extended that to the team that we were hiring. You know, we are very flexible with our warehouse employees when they have childcare issues or when employees want to work from somewhere else for a time being. We have a colleague in the UK right now for 6 weeks. So we just wanted to mirror, you know, our expectations for work-life balance or how we envisioned being entrepreneurial fitting into our lives instead of running our lives, kind of a parallel to food. So we extend that to the team as well.
So we're going to take a break, but Omri is still involved in the business? I wanted to ask you that.
Never really was, kind of tangentially.
Okay, gotcha.
But yes, he's still in the industry very much so. He's very integrated into the commodity exchange out of Ethiopia and tahini manufacturing now.
Very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, with that, let's take a short break. And let's pick up on the company culture when we come back.
The Sattel Institute is the leading CEO member organization dedicated to corporate social responsibility. Under the vision and leadership of its founder, entrepreneur and philanthropist Ed Sattel, the Institute brings together CEOs in Philadelphia and other cities to support the nonprofit organizations that do heroic work in our communities. The Sattel Institute believes that community is every leader's business. SI's members-only meetings and private CEO conferences give members the opportunity to hear from world-class thought leaders on crucial topics like AI, education, corporate philanthropy, and more. In addition, CEO members get the opportunity to share ideas and experience with their peers, like-minded CEOs who believe in the importance of giving back to the community and who understand the benefits companies get from embracing corporate social responsibility. The Sattel Institute charges no dues or fees. In order to join, member companies simply make a long-term commitment to the nonprofit of their choice. To find out more about membership and why so many leading companies are now part of the Sattel Institute, visit the organization's website at sattelinstitute.org. Sattel, S-A-T-E-L-L, institute.org. As Ed Sattel says, think we, not just me.
We are back on Founders Forum with our guest today, Amy Zeitelman. And Ange, you were talking about company culture. I think you wanted to dig into that a little further.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm fascinated by the family culture thing. And as I mentioned, I've got two sisters and we're in somewhat of a family kind of real estate sort of venture. And I know it's interesting how things can pop up. So it sounds like you're managing that beautifully, which is wonderful. So I'm curious, though, as you think about the business expanding, both footprint, revenue, I think you mentioned off air that you've got about 12 employees. So do you have a vision for... It's kind of a two-part question. How many people do you think you're going to grow this to, let's say, over the next year? And being that I come from the talent acquisition space for many years, I know how challenging it is to attract good employees, good staff. So do you have a thought around how you're attracting people, how many you think you might need to grow? And that'll tie into some other, you know, entrepreneurial growth questions too.
Yeah, a great question. As it relates to the team, right now our biggest growth is in inventory because we're, you know, starting to sell to more grocery stores and more consumer channels. We are moving more units of tahini than in the past. So operationally, that's where we're growing the most and have been since COVID, since we started accelerating into these consumer channels. For instance, before COVID, we had one warehouse employee, one warehouse manager, Rick. He and I worked really closely with one supply chain director. And now we have a supply chain director, a new warehouse manager, and four full-time warehouse employees. So the ops side of the business is definitely taking up the most recruitment. We're currently balancing that between what we want to keep in-house and what we might want to start doing with a 3PL or outsourced support as it relates to the ops, because we may not have, but we also may have maxed out our capacity for hiring, you know, in that field. Otherwise, though, we hope to be able to accomplish our growth with our core team right now. We've got two people in marketing. We want to hire one more salesperson towards the end of this year. And maybe from there, sales will continue to grow. But otherwise, we're really hoping to see the next stage of growth. We're hoping to end this year. We're on track to end this year around $8.5 million, $9 million. And we want to grow that. I know we're going to go into the 3-year picture to $25 million. And so we need the people that will, you know, facilitate that type of growth. And whether we want to bring on the team to hold that much inventory ourselves, or whether we want to outsource that in some capacity, are the decisions we're making right now.
Mm-hmm. So thanks for that lead in.
Yeah.
So if we're sitting here 3 years from now, this is one of my favorite questions, and we're looking at April of 2027, and you were looking back on the last 3 years, what would have to happen? So you already talked about sales for the business, where you'd like that to be. What would else happen in your company vision and your personal vision, if you'd like?
Yeah. Well, also closing the loop on your question, but it fits in tremendously, which is the culture that we're building and how we hire and retain people. I mean, we're really proud. Our assistant warehouse manager, Rick, I was talking about him from COVID. He's been with us now for 6 years, you know, and people share with me that's very hard to accomplish. And that's because we really hire and we run the business through our values. You might be familiar with EOS, the Entrepreneurial Operating System.
Traction.
Love it.
Traction.
Yep.
We adopted that 2 years ago, but it was kind of rustling around in my brain for the past right before COVID. Since like 2019, I read Traction, and then I really started implementing it 2 years ago now. And when we started hiring for the values and making and having that very clear accountability chart, what that person would be accountable for, responsible for, people really fall into place or they fall out of place. It's so much easier this way.
It couldn't articulate that better.
Yeah,
especially in EOS models.
Mm-hmm. And so EOS is how we are shaping the way to 3 years. And that's how we establish this revenue goal, other piece goals. Of course, it's the right people, the right seats. I think 80% is our goal, but we're a small team. We're going for 100% over here.
Do you do EOS yourself or do you have a facilitator?
We have a facilitator. Nice. Yeah, he facilitated us through the first 2 years. And this year now we're just doing like the quarterly, you know, or even just two quarterlies together. It's kind of a light. We're EOS light because we're such a small team right now.
Right.
On our leadership team. It's just four of us, myself, a chief growth officer who sits as the integrator, somebody from ops and somebody from finance. My goal would be to maybe find somebody for marketing to really help facilitate that growth and where I'm sitting right now.
Yeah, I just want to highlight that real quick, the fact that, because I think we're all such fans of EOS, and I do a lot of business consulting with small firms as well. And for our listeners that aren't familiar with it, I just want to highlight the point that a lot of times when you're a smaller company, companies feel like we don't have the resources to hire that right now. And I feel like you're a great example of when you do that and you invest in that, the ultimate payoff is that you do have such exponential and structured growth from an operational standpoint. So I think it's really brilliant that you've done that at this stage in the company's evolution.
Well, I appreciate that. I learned a lesson early on, or not early on, that it's so much better when hard things happen now as opposed to in 2 years. That was the biggest learning, talk about challenges, was a recall that we had in 2018. And going through it was so, so hard. You asked about the support of sisters. There were days when I didn't want to pick up the phone and make one more call, and Shelby would encourage me, we can do it. Just stick to our values. Just be honest. Answer their questions. And there were days when Shelby would say, how are we going to get through this? You know, our products have been delisted from Amazon and it's getting very challenging to get them back up. And I would say, well, just take it one day at a time. So, but when you have that clear direction and when you make the mistakes when you're younger, it gets so much easier than when you're bigger, because a bigger business, bigger problem, it doesn't get any easier.
I think it's important because that's one of those things that to me mirrors life. If you don't know to ask for help, or you don't have the vulnerability as a business to ask for the right help, then those problems do snowball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything gets worse.
So I want to ask you about challenges about your next 3 years, and I also want to ask you about your family. So I'll feed you one. You have three boys. You have a busy husband, it sounds like, and you have a busy business that you run. How's that all work out? What kind of challenge is that for you?
It's been a challenge. Each stage of having another kid brought more challenges. But we have great childcare. I guess that's the biggest thing that helps us. Just started with an au pair this year also. And our mom was an entrepreneur, and she worked a lot in the first part of her motherhood, I would say. She retired when I was 12. And I remember asking her about that, like, how did you do it all? And she said, I got help, you know, either with childcare or great nursery schools or whatever it was. And she said, I knew that other people could participate in this stage of your life very, you know, tremendously when you were little. And it was when you were 12 and Shelby, your oldest sister, was 16 that I realized, like, oh, I need to mom more now, right? I think it was bigger kazoo. I'm like, feel like two different people, you know, but with tremendous community and support, and same with building the right team, building the right structure in your personal life helps a lot also.
I will say my wife, who's was a family therapist, so she's working with families. And she got to that point when my son was 12 and she said, got to slow this down and maybe even stop, because this is when the kids really, you know, and she relied on her mother and babysitters and support. But she said, I really need to be hands-on. So I completely get that. And I was very busy in business and did what I could, but she had to really take the ball and run with it at that point with the kids. So certainly understand that. Let's talk about a couple fun things. What book are you currently reading?
So I'm currently reading The Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, yeah. Great. And you had read it before?
I had, not since high school or college, or maybe another time in college, but I needed a book. I have to read every night, a non-business book. Sometimes I read a paragraph, sometimes I read 10 pages, but that's the way I shut down my brain. So I'll grab any book and reread it at any time.
I'm working on that one myself. I used to read inspirational, growth-oriented, personal development, business books. Not good. So I'm working on trying to get fiction back in my life. So I understand that. And tell me about your legacy. What do you think about this? Because you're doing some pretty important things in a lot of ways.
Thank you. I think about my legacy as a mother, of course, and my contribution to my community. Our parents have definitely laid a foundation of philanthropy, you know, expectations. So I just see all of this as a tremendous opportunity to make a small impact in this, my own micro or even larger economy, my own family economy, you know, my community economy. It's just, it's amazing. I'm turning 35 on Friday, and like, it's an interesting stage where,
you're the day before me.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Where you realize as an adult, you can contribute a lot to things and you can take that opportunity or not.
That's great. Are you trying to integrate philanthropy into Zoom at all?
Oh, great question. We are. I mean, very, as much as we can, we donate a lot of product to organizations that align with where we focus our philanthropy, which is on nutrition education, food access, and then also career development, primarily in food and beverage or so. So we try to.
That's wonderful. With that, I think we're just about at the end of our time. So, Amy, so great to have you here today. It was a fun show. It was delightful. You did a great job. I know you haven't done a lot of this, but you're obviously accomplished at speaking and talking about your business eloquently. So thanks for being here. And thanks to all of you for listening on Founders Forum today. Thank you, Ange, for being here. And everybody, have a great day.
Life can only be understood backwards, but it must be lived looking forward. At the intersection of justice and community lies the Looking Forward Show, sponsored in part by the PD Green Program. The PD Green Program supports the academic goals of incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people through high-quality volunteer tutoring programs. This is the Looking Forward Show.
Join Jeffrey Abramowitz Tuesdays at 4 on WWDB AM 860 97.5 HD2 and by podcast and stream always at WWDBAM.com.
Ciao! I am Melissa Canavo Marino, inviting you to join me and Nick Alessandrini right here on WWDB 860 every Sunday afternoon from 2 to 3 for Viaggio Musicale. The program features Italian and Italian-American classics, both old and new, with some of Italy's best-known singers, as well as Italian-American performers like Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Al Martino, just to name a few. It all happens right here on WWDB 860. Non dovete mancare. I can't wait for you to tune in. A presto.
When the Wall Street Journal needed expert views on crisis intervention and mental health, they called the consortium. When the United States Department of Health and Human Services needed to launch their national 988 hotline, they came to the consortium, and so can you. Here's consortium CEO John White Jr.
Mental wellness influences so many aspects of our lives. Long before the headlines, we were on the front lines. We've been pioneering the art of helping people feel better for more than 50 years. Our expertise is unsurpassed. Today, so many people are under a lot of pressure, telling themselves,